Hello, everybody. I'm Danny Boom Boom McCarthy.
Just one more word. You frustrate the state and the vengeance that is due it for the transgressions of this evil old man. The crime will fall on your own heads. Vengeance of the gods will be on you.
The accused will speak now.
Men of Athens, how you have been affected by my accusers, I cannot tell. I know they almost made me forget who I am. Of the many falsehoods told by them, one amazed me, saying that you should be on guard against my eloquence. If by eloquence they mean truth, then I'm eloquent. But I am an old man appearing in a court of law for the first time. So please think only of the truth of my words, not their awkwardness. Henutus and his associates are dangerous to me. But far more dangerous to me are the others, the ones who began accusing me when you were children and long ago took possession of your minds with their lies. They claim I'm a student of natural science and refer to a comedy by Aristophanes in which a man called Socrates talks nonsense, or they liken me to those who teach for money and instruct in how to make the worst cause appear the better. If you have ever heard me hold forth on these matters, I ask you to speak out now. A friend of mine, who most of you knew, Chaerephon, once went to the oracle at Delphi.
Pythian prophetess, who speaks with the tongue of Apollo? Is any man wiser than Socrates? Priestess?
No man is wiser than Socrates. No man is wiser than Socrates. No man is wiser than Socrates.
When I heard that, I asked myself, what can the god mean? For I know I have no wisdom, yet can gods lie? I thought, if I can find a man wiser than myself, surely no great task, then the oracle is mistaken. So I went to a politician with a reputation for wisdom. But when I spoke with him, I could not help thinking that he wasn't really wise at all, no matter what people said. I tried to explain that to him, but he became irritated with me. I thought, well, neither of us knows anything really beautiful or profound, but at least I am better off than this fellow, because he knows nothing and thinks he knows everything, while I know nothing. So I went from one person to another in search of a wise man. This inquiry, men of Athens, has made me many enemies, but it has led me to believe that only the gods are wise. And the oracle used my name by way of illustration. What he meant is, he is wisest who, like Socrates, knows that his wisdom is worth nothing.
Religions have creation myths of gods and divine mothers and men formed from clay. Nations have founding myths of heroes and good kings. The origin myth of philosophy is the story of a court case and an execution. Philosophy was born in death. I refer, of course, to the trial and condemnation of Socrates. Welcome to The Story of Nowhere, Episode 2, A Brief History of Critical Thinking, Part 2, The Life Examined. The story of Socrates' last days is contained in his student Plato's three short works, Apology, Crito, and Phaedo, and to many, these are the founding texts of philosophy. Yet, of Socrates the man, we can know almost nothing. We hear of him mostly through the dialogues of Plato. He's mentioned enough by other contemporaries like Xenophon, Aristophanes, and Aristotle for us to be sure that he existed. But aside from that, he's a mystery. Plato designs in Socrates the perfect philosopher, a man patient, practical, wise, and courageous to the death. Plato's Socrates truly is a lovely character, one in every way deserving of his position at the fountainhead of philosophy. But this Socrates is a character. We can't know how much of what he says in the dialogues is actually Plato's philosophy put into the mouth of the master, for the real Socrates wrote nothing. But he did speak. Of this there can be no doubt. Socrates bothered every Athenian he could in the market, collaring a snarky aristocrat one day and amusing poet the next, always asking, why? But the so-called Socratic method of inquiry is far more than just asking why over and over again like some annoying kid. Socrates would get those he encountered to define their terms, then define the terms of their terms. He would pierce deeper into a person's belief than they ever had, and reveal that they, like Socrates himself, in fact, knew nothing. It sounds simple, but that was the basis of his method from which all subsequent philosophy would derive. Unlike Thales, Pythagoras, and Xenophanes who came before him, Socrates didn't claim any special knowledge of the universe, nor did he concern himself too deeply with the sciences. He was concerned with how individuals would live their lives, and he insisted that he could only be called wise because he knew that he knew nothing. This simplicity and forthrightness made him into such a force that we still speak of him today. So let's take a look at Socrates' critical thinking in action. As you'd expect, the formula for the Socratic method is preserved in the works of Plato. Thus, it's difficult to see where the critical thinking of Socrates ends and the critical thinking of Plato begins. But I'll just avoid that whole argument and grant them both equal credit, and turn to Plato's magnum opus, The Republic, for a rather famous exhibition of the Socratic method. In Book 1 of The Republic, Socrates and his friends commence a discussion which would go on for 9 more books. They seek the meaning of justice. Thrasymachus, a gruff sophist, claims to know the meaning of the term. He asserts that, quote, "the just is none other than the advantage of the stronger," unquote. Basically, he's saying that might makes right. This is Thrasymachus's position. Socrates forces him to further clarify that, by this, he means that no matter what kind of government a state has, the one thing that unites all states is that it is just to conform to its dictates. So says Thrasymachus, quote, "a democracy sets down democratic laws, a tyranny, tyrannic laws, and others do the same. In every city the same thing is just, the advantage of the established ruling body. It is surely master, so the man who reasons rightly concludes that everywhere justice is the same thing, the advantage of the stronger." Unquote. Socrates then sets out to analyze Thrasymachus's claim by asking a string of questions and insisting that Thrasymachus remain consistent with his initial argument. Turning now to their exchange in the Republic, we will hear first from Socrates and then Thrasymachus's response.
"We must examine whether what you say is true. Like you, I agree that justice is something that is good for a person, but while you qualify it as what is good for the stronger, I'm not so sure. We should examine the question."
"Go on, then. Examine it."
"I shall," I said. "Tell me, don't you also say that it is right for subjects to obey their rulers?"
"I do."
"And are they infallible, the rulers in all these cities? Or are they capable of making mistakes?"
"They are certainly, I imagine, capable of making mistakes."
"So, when they set about enacting laws, do they enact some correctly, but a certain number incorrectly?" In my opinion, yes. And correctly is enacting laws which are in their own interest, and incorrectly is enacting laws which are against their own interest. Is that what you mean? Yes. But whatever they enact, their subjects must carry it out, and this is justice. Of course. In that case, according to your definition, it is not only just to do what is good for the stronger, but also its opposite, what is not good for him. What do you mean? He said. I mean what you mean, I think. Let's look at it more closely. Haven't we agreed that the rulers, in giving orders to their subjects to do anything, sometimes make mistakes about what is in their own best interest, but that it is just for the subjects to carry out whatever orders their rulers give them? Isn't that what we have agreed? Yes, he said, I accept that. Then you must also accept, I said, that we have agreed it is just to do things which are not good for the rulers and the stronger, when the rulers inadvertently issue orders which are harmful to themselves, and you say it is just for their subjects to carry out the orders of their rulers. In that situation, most wise Thrasymachus, isn't the inevitable result that it is just to do the exact opposite of what you say? After all, the weaker have been ordered to do what is not good for the stronger.
So there, in that short passage, we see the formula of the Socratic method laid bare. A claim is made and then clarified. Justice is to the advantage of the strong, meaning that the strong will issue commands that suit their interests, and it is just for the people to follow these commands. Then Socrates probes deeper into that claim by revealing what it presupposes. Do the commands of the strong always suit their interests, or might they make mistakes? Thrasymachus concedes that even the strong will make mistakes from time to time and issue dictates that are against their interest. But the just man or woman must follow all the dictates of the strong, Socrates asks? Yes. So by examining the presuppositions that underlie the initial claim, Socrates shows that the claim itself is contradictory. If the just individual follows all the dictates of the strong, but these dictates are sometimes against the interests of the strong, then justice, according to Thrasymachus' logic, must both be to the advantage and disadvantage of the strong. His claim is undermined and shown to be paradoxical. Thus, his assertion that justice is to the advantage of the strong can be eliminated. This is the style of Socrates throughout all of the Platonic texts. Here's another example of the method in action in the dialogue Euthyphro, as explained in a YouTube video entitled What is the Socratic Method? Illustrated by the channel The Polymath's Paradise.
Socrates approaches each discussion from a place of irony, and this Socratic irony, as the 19th century Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard would later call it, is an invitation for the interlocutor or conversation partner to hold court on the subject. After all, they're the proclaimed experts of their field, so they would be best suited to educate Socrates on these matters. Essentially, Socratic irony is the use of flattery, or by some accounts sarcasm, to prompt the other person into explaining what they think is the case. An excellent example can be found at the beginning of the Platonic dialogue Euthyphro, where Socrates encounters the eponymous prophet and becomes interested in the fact that Euthyphro is prosecuting his own father. Euthyphro maintains that it is the pious or godly thing to do. Socrates compliments him on the direction of his piety and says, ironically, "It is indeed most important, my admirable Euthyphro, that I should become your pupil." Now, some might say that this is insincere, but let us remember that Socrates is presuming that the wise men of Athens are to be believed when it comes to their expertise. Who better than Euthyphro to help attain a good understanding of the gods? After this encouragement, Euthyphro makes a comment about the nature of piety, which allows Socrates to now ask, "So tell me now, by Zeus, what you just now maintained you clearly knew. What kind of thing do you say godliness and ungodliness are?" The irony here was necessary in facilitating the discussion and therefore evaluating Euthyphro's position. The scholar Gregory Vlastos identifies this as the first stage of the Socratic method, which in ancient Greek is called elenchus. Where were we? Oh yes, Socrates asks Euthyphro to explain the nature of godliness, and Euthyphro nonchalantly responds that him prosecuting his father and pretty much stuff like that are piety. Now, of course, this reply fails to answer the question, doing very little to reveal the nature of piety, instead only offering an example of it. But don't worry, Socrates sees through this and sharply holds him to an answer. Now, finally, Euthyphro asserts, "What is holy is that what is dear to the gods." Great, so this leads to the second Olenchic stage, as discerned by Vlastos. Socrates identifies a claim and determines its veracity. The way he does so is always through clarification. So he says, "The thing and the person that are dear to the gods are holy, and the thing and the person that are hateful to the gods are unholy." He recaps carefully. "The holy and the unholy are the exact opposites of each other. Is this not what we have said?" And Euthyphro assents and goes, yes. "Well then," Socrates continues, "have we said this also, that the gods, Euthyphro, quarrel and disagree with each other, and that there is enmity between them?" Euthyphro agrees again, "Yes, we have said that." Now this here is a process of mietics, or philosophical midwifery, as it is described by Plato in the dialogue The Theaetetus. The idea of the technique is that by coercing the interlocutor to agree with a series of subsequent statements, Socrates draws out the truth. And this mietic encouragement is what Vlastos distinguishes as the third stage of Olenchus. Now the fourth stage, by the way, is where Socrates turns up the heat, because it's here that he implies that the subsequent statements are contrary to the original statement. Let us again defer to the Euthyphro dialogue as a demonstration. Socrates gets Euthyphro to agree that in numerical disagreements, one turns to arithmetic to solve it, in dimensional disagreements, one turns to objective measurement, and that in disagreements of mass, one can resort to weighing. The only disagreement that will cause animosity or rift must therefore be a matter without obvious resolution, matters of right and wrong. "Yes, Socrates," Euthyphro agrees, "these are the questions about which we should become enemies." The mad gadfly then queries, "And how about the gods? Some of the gods too think some things are right or wrong, and noble or disgraceful, and good or bad, and others disagree, for they would not war with each other if they did not disagree about these matters." And Euthyphro confirms that this is a good summary once more. So Socrates continues, "Yes, the gods in each group love the things which they consider good and right, and hate the opposites of these things." And Euthyphro, confirms, this time a bit more laconically, "But you say that some things are considered right by some of them and wrong by others, and it's because they disagree about these things." "Yes," says Euthyphro. "Then, as it seems," says Socrates, "the same things are hated and loved by the gods, and the same things would be dear and hateful to the gods. Then the same things would be both holy and unholy, Euthyphro, according to the statement." "I suppose so," Euthyphro admits. This whole exchange leads to this final concession, which itself is aporic, meaning embodying aporia, or doubt. At this juncture, it seems that the words of Robert Burns were correct. There is no such uncertainty as a sure thing. Although this is not the end of the dialogue, it does a good job at embodying the fifth and final stage of Olenchus, the demonstration that the original proposition was false.
So we see that Euthyphro's claim, like Thrasymachus's, can be cut from the list of what might be true. This is the whole point of the Socratic method. It eliminates answers that must be false, and by way of elimination, brings Socrates and his audience closer to the truth. The trouble Socrates found was that no so-called expert on any subject in the whole city of Athens actually knew any truth. He poked holes in all the official arguments, found contradictions in the city's theology, and illustrated fundamental problems with the government itself. For daring to ask anything of anyone, Socrates was charged with the crimes of impiety and of corrupting the minds of the youth. Socrates caused the original satanic panic. But even to the end, when he insisted on defending himself at the trial, Socrates stayed true to his method and thoroughly undermined the charges made by his accusers.
"Is he as wisest who, like Socrates, knows that his wisdom is worth nothing? And what my enemies will never admit is that they're really angry because their pretense of knowledge has been shown up. Meletus, you good man, and true lover of your country, rise. Let me ask you a question. You think much about the improvement of youth.
I do.
Tell the jurors, then, who are the improvers of youth? You must know, since you've taken the pains to discover their corrupter.
The laws improve youth.
But who knows the laws?
The jurors.
They're able to instruct and improve youth.
They are.
All of them or only some?
All of them.
By Hera, that's good news. There are plenty of improvers. How about the people watching the trial today?
They are also improvers.
And the members of the Athenian Assembly, do they improve or corrupt?
Improve.
Evidently, every Athenian improves and elevates youth while I alone corrupt them. Is that what you affirm?
I strongly affirm that you are their corrupter.
What about horses, Miletus? Takes an expert trainer to bring out the best in a horse, yet you claim an entire city can train our youths while only I corrupt them.
This is the word-playing of a sophist.
As to the other part of your indictment, you say that I refuse to recognize the gods of the state. Does this mean that I do not believe in gods at all? That I'm an atheist?
I assure you, jurors, he believes in no gods whatsoever.
Yet your charge also claims that I'm guilty of introducing new divinities of my own. You claim that I'm guilty both of believing in gods and not believing in gods. Can a man believe in human affairs and not humans, or horsemanship and not horses, or flute playing and not flute players? Surely you jest.
Ah, but alas, despite that applause, Socrates' defense was not enough to quell the hasty emotionalism of the Athenian jury. Socrates was the kind of guy who walks into a gorgeous mansion that's for sale, full of priceless art and surrounded by lush gardens, and goes straight down to the basement to check the foundation for cracks. A bit of a buzzkill, yes, but one that could save you an awful lot of trouble if you just listened to him. But instead, the democratic people of Athens sentenced him to death. In 399 BC, he died in cooperation with the order of execution. The student Plato followed in the footsteps of the master. As I've already pointed out, knowing exactly where he differed from his teacher is hard to tell. But because Plato didn't begin to write until after Socrates' death, it seems safe to say that the texts we have are more Platonic than Socratic. After Socrates' execution, Plato fled Athens and traveled the surrounding world. He went to Egypt, where he learned that history was far older than he had come to believe living among the Greeks, and was struck by the longevity and efficiency of that country's ruling priest class. According to Will Durant, Plato's admiration for the Egyptian elites would later play a role in the formulation of the utopia he wrote about in his Republic. He returned to Athens in 387 BC, whereupon he founded his famous academy. Here, all the curious of the city could gather and discuss ideas and learn from the great Plato himself. While there, Plato wrote his dialogues, the first true philosophical texts, and, evoking Socrates, passed down to history a method of strict inquiry. The examination of the premises of one's argument is an absolute requirement for critical thinking, for if one is to accurately map the world in his or her mind, he or she must be sure to stand on solid ground. Even still, the Socratic method only eliminated what was not true. It failed to reveal anything definitive about the world. Thus, it's not a complete art of critical thought. That would come just two generations after Socrates, from Plato's best and most cantankerous student, Aristotle. Aristotle, who lived from 384 to 322 BC, rekindled in philosophy the pre-Socratic concern with the natural sciences. He established his own academy, distinct from Plato's, which he called the Lyceum or Peripatetic School.
It was not hard for the instructor of the King of Kings to find pupils even in so hostile a city as Athens. When, in the 53rd year of his age, Aristotle established his school, the Lyceum, so many students flocked to him that it became necessary to make complicated regulations for the maintenance of order. The students themselves determined the rules and elected every 10 days one of their number to supervise the school. but we must not think of it as a place of rigid discipline. Rather, the picture which comes down to us is of scholars eating their meals in common with the master, and learning from him as he and they strolled up and down the walk along the athletic field from which the Lyceum took its name. The walk was called Peripatos, hence the later name Peripatetic School. The athletic field was part of the grounds of the temple of Apollo Lysias, the protector of the flock against the wolf, Lycos. The new school was no mere replica of that which Plato had left behind him. The academy was devoted above all to mathematics and to speculative and political philosophy. The Lyceum had rather a tendency to biology and the natural sciences. If we may believe Pliny, Alexander instructed his hunters, gamekeepers, gardeners, and fishermen to furnish Aristotle with all the zoological and botanical material he might desire. Other ancient writers tell us that at one time he had at his disposal 1,000 men scattered throughout Greece and Asia, collecting for him specimens of the fauna and flora of every land. With this wealth of material, he was enabled to establish the first great zoological garden that the world had seen. We can hardly exaggerate the influence of this collection upon his science and his philosophy. Where did Aristotle derive the funds to finance these undertakings? He was himself, by this time, a man of spacious income, and he had married into the fortune of one of the most powerful public men in Greece. Athenaeus, no doubt with some exaggeration, relates that Alexander gave Aristotle, for physical and biological equipment and research, the sum of 800 talents, in modern purchasing power some $4 million. It was at Aristotle's suggestion, some think, that Alexander sent a costly expedition to explore the sources of the Nile and discover the causes of its periodical overflow. The expedition reported that the inundations were due to the melting of the snow on the mountains of Abyssinia. Such works as the Digest of 158 Political Constitutions, drawn up for Aristotle, indicate a considerable corps of aides and secretaries. In short, we have here the first example in European history of the large-scale financing of science by public wealth. What knowledge would we not win if modern states were to support research on a proportionately lavish scale?
With resources such as these, a man could become the Da Vinci of his day, and Aristotle was exactly that. In fact, we might more accurately say that Da Vinci was trying his hand at being the Aristotle of his day. Unlike Socrates, Aristotle wrote. Unlike Plato, he wrote in his own voice. And boy did he write! Biology, physics, meteorology, poetics, politics, ethics, metaphysics, in all of these areas, Aristotle was the first expert. But of all of the subjects he concerned himself with, only one concerns us today, his development of the science of logic. If Socrates or Plato prepared the kindling for formal critical thinking, then it was Aristotle, in his set of logical works called the Organon, who lit the match and set the world on fire. So let's just take a look at some of the basics of Aristotelian or classical logic. To start with, there are three major rules or laws of logic. These are called axioms, which basically just means something that's taken to be true or something that proves itself true. That might sound kind of questionable at first, but just listen to what the three axioms are, and then you'll see why they're just generally accepted as true. First, there's the law of identity. This axiom very simply states that a thing is what it is. Aristotle is Aristotle, Socrates is Socrates. The law of identity adds no new information. It only states that A is A. Second, the law of non-contradiction. This states that a thing is not what it is not. Pretty heavy stuff, right? So, Aristotle is not anybody but Aristotle, and Socrates is not anybody but Socrates. A is not not A. Notice that this axiom is a double negative, and we all know what to do with double negatives. They cancel out and become positive. So really, to say A is not not A is to say that A is A. The second axiom is basically the first axiom. It just approaches the same principle from the opposite point of view. Third, there is the law of the excluded middle. Guess what? This law is also just another way of saying the same thing as the other two. It states that a thing can either be A or not A, but it cannot be both at the same time. So, a man can either be Aristotle or not be Aristotle, but he can't be both Aristotle and not Aristotle simultaneously. In other words, A is not not A. A is A. To move forward in Aristotelian or classical logic, you must accept all of these laws. This is because the axioms define the rules of categories, which are what Aristotle's logic deals with. This is important to note, because one might be tempted to get nitpicky with these basic rules and try to refute them. For instance, imagine a river. Let's call it the Red River. The Red River runs into the Brown Sea. According to the laws of logic, A is A. So, the Red River is not the Brown Sea. It's the Red River, and vice versa. But, somebody might come along and say, well, wait a minute. We don't really know where the Red River turns into the Brown Sea. At what exact point does the water cease to be river water and become seawater? Where does the river end and the sea begin? If you spend a long time dwelling on this, you may conclude that the axioms are false, because there is no clear, absolute, and immutable distinction between the river and the sea. These are just verbal or conceptual constructs. Dwell on this long enough, and you might say, hey man, I guess the water can be both river water and sea water at the same time. A is not A. I guess we can do away with logic. After all, it's just an illusion, man. Another problem. Imagine the Red River again. Everything about that river is changing on an instant-to-instant basis. Water rushes by, stirring the sediment. Fish and bugs flop all around, stones roll in, it's constantly transforming. As the pre-Socratic thinker Heraclitus supposedly said, you cannot step into the same river twice. That is to say, the Red River is only that particular river for an instant. An instant later, it's another river, and an instant later, it's another river still. A is not A. We can even say the same of human beings. Are you really the same person you were 10 years ago? 1 year ago? Yesterday? 1 second ago? Sure, the changes that have occurred in the last second are probably pretty minor, maybe even unnoticeable, but they were changes, right? Again, if you dwell on this too long, you might say that A is not A. I am not me, and there is no logic. The problem with these problems with logic is that they overlook the domain of logic. As I said, classical logic deals with categories. A category is a set of specific conditions describing an object, place, event, time, or being that separate or distinguish that thing from every other thing. Dividing the world up into categories is, incidentally, one of the things that distinguishes humans from other animals. We discussed this a little bit last time when we looked at prehistoric peoples and addressed the importance of abstraction, or pulling ideas out of things, when it comes to the creative and technological capacity of the human mind. Categorization had long been going on for who the hell knows how long, but Aristotle was the one to articulate the process and give us a formula for weighing abstract categories against each other. So to get hung up on where the river becomes the sea, is to get hung up on a practically inconsequential level. River is a category that describes a large stream of water that empties into a sea. And then, more specifically, the Red River is this particular large stream of water that specifically empties into the Brown Sea. To confuse the river for the sea would be practically absurd because, categorically, A is A. It is the categories that logic is concerned with, and it's the logical analysis of categories that makes the actual materials they refer to so practically useful to us. So you can dwell on the issues of where the river really ends and if it's really the same river and all that stuff if you want, but just know that that level of analysis isn't really what we're concerned with here. We're talking about categories and their relationships, and in my opinion, the practical achievements of categorical logic speak for themselves, even if it is all an illusion, man. All right, let's talk about some of the actual logical stuff now. Like I said in the last episode, I'm not going to take up too much time talking about all the formal logic stuff, but with Aristotle, there's really just no avoiding it. He's definitely the most important character in our story so far, and his logic is going to deeply influence literally everything we cover from this point on. So we better have a decent understanding of just what it was he was going on about. We'll just take a look at the basics of what constitutes a logical argument. To begin with, an argument is not a fight or a quarrel or a row, as some people say. It's merely an attempt to back something up with reasons. There are two basic types of logical argument, according to Aristotle, inductive and deductive. He himself was focused far more on the deductive than the inductive, and so we will focus on the same here. But very quickly, an inductive argument reasons from particulars to generalities. So one might say, this ear of corn is yellow. That ear of corn is yellow. Every ear of corn I've ever seen is yellow. Therefore, all ears of corn are yellow. This is deceptively sensible. See, even though this argument actually turns out to be incorrect, you can understand how somebody who had only ever seen yellow ears of corn might come to the conclusion that all ears of corn were that color. But because this person is dealing with just a small sample, the corn he's seen, he can only say that it is probable that all or most corn is yellow. He cannot conclude for sure that all corn is yellow because his conclusion goes beyond the scope of his premises, his experience. Induction only ever deals in probability, not certainty, and for this reason, Aristotle had very little to say about it. But before you write off induction as the stupid logic, consider that it is inductive reasoning that lies underneath the scientific method. Assessing the probability of general truths based on observed particulars is the very soul of modern science. But we'll talk about that in 2,000 years or so. Aristotle was much more interested in the other kind of argument, the one that deals in certainty, not probability. This is the deductive argument. In his Prior Analytics, Aristotle says, quote, "A deduction is speech in which, certain things having been supposed, something different from those supposed results of necessity because of their being so." Unquote. Now, I know that's some funky wording there, but I promise it's actually pretty simple. A deductive argument, he's saying, is composed of two parts, those things supposed, premises, and that which necessarily follows from those suppositions, the conclusion. It's because deduction starts with generalities and reasons down to particulars that it can be said to deal in certainty. With this being the case, if a deductive argument is structured properly and its premises are true, its conclusion must be true. Consider again the Red River and the Brown Sea. A deductive argument or syllogism about them might be Premise 1. The Red River is the only river that flows into the Brown Sea. Premise 2. This river flows into the Brown Sea. Conclusion. Therefore, this is the Red River. If it is true that the Red River is the only river that flows into the Brown Sea, and if it is true that this river right here is flowing into the Brown Sea, then this river must be the Red River. This is a valid argument. The classic sample argument offered by Aristotle is, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. This, too, is valid. If the premises of man, mortality, and Socrates' manhood are true, then the conclusion must also be true. So let's get back to our corn example. Suppose we argue, all ears of corn are yellow. This is an ear of corn. Therefore, this ear of corn is yellow. Yet again, this is a valid argument. But hey, you'll say, it's not true that all corn is yellow. And you'd be right. and the argument would still be valid. Remember that, to be valid, the conclusion only has to follow from the premises. If all corn were yellow, and you got yourself an ear of it, you could be sure that it would be yellow. All females have mustaches. My neighbor's infant daughter is a female. Therefore, my neighbor's infant daughter has a mustache. This is a totally valid logical argument. This is also why it's so important to check the premises of your arguments. Validity alone does not guarantee the veracity of an argument. An argument is considered sound when it is both valid and all of its premises are true. The structure or form of a deductive argument, called a syllogism, can be illustrated by substituting simple letters for the premises and conclusion. All A's are B's. All B's are C's. Therefore, all A's are C's. See? Easy peasy. But what about invalid arguments? They're out there too, yes they are. An argument is structurally invalid if its conclusion could be false, even if all the premises were true. The form of such an argument, or really non-argument, might go like this. All A's are B's. All C's are B's. Therefore, all C's are A's. The simplest way to demonstrate why such a structure is invalid is to just plug in some terms and see what happens. All snakes are reptiles. Turtles are reptiles. Therefore, all turtles are snakes. The premises are both certainly true, and yet the conclusion is not. Therefore, the argument is invalid. Now, there are certainly more technical rules and explanations for why this form of argument is invalid, but we're not going to get into that here. I think it's pretty intuitively obvious why this is a fallacious or erroneous argument. There's so much more that could be said about Aristotle's logic, and so much more has been said in books and lectures over the years that I really feel comfortable just moving on. If you're interested in learning more about the science of logic, I'd recommend A Rulebook for Arguments by Anthony Weston, The Craft of Research by Booth, Coulomb, and Williams, Socratic Logic by Peter Kreeft, and of course, if you're feeling bold, Aristotle's Organon itself. I'll link to all of these books in the show notes, as well as to some other online resources on the subject, so be sure you check that out. Now that we've had a very, and I mean very, basic overview of Aristotle's logic, we can return to our story. As we've already heard, having Alexander the Great as a student meant that Aristotle enjoyed material resources that no philosopher up to that point could have ever imagined. It also meant that his philosophy was spread throughout what was, at the time, the largest empire on earth. Archimedes, Aristarchus, Theophrastus, and other scientists would be born after Aristotle and continue the tradition of seeking natural causes for things and events. But everything comes to an end eventually. Alexander was dead at the young age of 32, leaving his empire to be fought over by power-hungry generals. Still, Greek culture continued to spread far and wide throughout the Mediterranean and Middle Eastern worlds, though soon this hegemony would be replaced by the up-and-coming Roman Empire. Though Rome came to dominate what was once the Greek world and beyond, their culture was unmistakably dominated by Greek culture. The Romans worshipped Zeus and Athena and Artemis, only under different names. They studied Greek philosophy and expanded on Greek art. This cultural appropriation by a conquering force was beneficial in two ways. First, it gave the Romans a leg up in their aesthetics, politics, and philosophy as they submitted themselves to the tutelage of the Greek masters. Second, it meant that they preserved what less scrupulous conquerors would have mindlessly destroyed. Had they not borrowed from and modified what the Greeks left, who knows what would have been lost to the sands of time? Now, obviously, that's not to say that this transmission was perfect. Greco-Roman culture inevitably leaned Roman as attitudes changed and social situations evolved. At times, there was even resistance to Greek influence. Sure, it was one thing to read Greek philosophy and learn from Greek history, but it was a whole other thing entirely to behave like the Greeks. Romans like Cato the Censor argued that Greek effeminacy and loose sexual practices would corrupt the old Roman morality. So, as is the case in any cultural collision, there are bound to be shifts and alterations on both sides, and there's also a certain degradation of the original culture, the Greek culture, that happened over time. We're going to look at one very important shift or alteration as we wind out this episode. But just understand that at the bottom of Roman culture is a whole lot of Greece. For much of its history, Republican and Imperial, a dominant philosophy held by free and thinking Romans was Stoicism. As you could guess, Stoicism was originally a Greek philosophy, named for the Stoa, or porch, that its founder Zeno lectured from. The Greek Stoics taught, much like the pre-Socratic Xenophanes, that a single God bound everything in the universe together, and that humans could only hope to come close to this one true God by applying reason to the output received from their five senses. Will Durant says of this Stoic God, quote, "Reason is the supreme achievement of man, a seed from the logos spermaticos, or seminal reason, that made and rules the world," unquote. So concerned were these thinkers with living in harmony with divine will that they contributed virtually nothing to the sciences. The pursuit of knowledge was seen as nothing more than a means to an end, the end being a life of virtue. So, to the Stoics, science was superfluous. Biology, astronomy, and other Greek sciences waned in Rome, in favor of more practical intellectual endeavors. The Romans are still famous for their engineering and hygienic genius, and this honor is rightly deserved, and the hard-nosed, practical philosophy of the Stoics is rightly credited. Additionally, Stoicism was an attempt, and a largely successful attempt, at breaking philosophy once and for all from the superstitious old gods like Zeus, Poseidon, Hades, and the rest that Socrates had been put to death for denying. With its stern, pragmatic, and contemplative injunctions, it was Stoicism that soaked most into Roman civilization, advising the wise and deliberative republic and spurring the martial success of the empire. With their humility, their welcoming of all sexes and classes, their denial of the passions, their belief in psyche, or soul, in animals, and logos, or reason, in humanity, and their deference to an omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent natural order, it's easy to see, in retrospect, how the Stoics paved the way for the rise of Christianity, which would soon perch itself in the center of the city of Rome. The other Greek philosophies, however, those of Plato and Aristotle, didn't have the same staying power in this new and strange land. At least, not in their pure forms. As Rome inched away from naturalistic philosophy, Aristotle slowly faded from the Western mind. His works were finally translated from Greek into Latin in the 6th century AD by the Roman Boethius, and even then, only the Organon was translated. Luckily, Arab philosophers, particularly Avicenna of Bukhara and Averroes, continued to ponder the works of Aristotle, and it's thanks to men like this that Aristotle eventually reclaimed a central spot in the Western canon, though not until the 12th century. For much of medieval history, it was instead the philosophy of Plato, or at least a modified version of Plato's philosophy, that animated Europe's thinking population. To see how this happened, and to set the stage for the next episode where we look at the Middle Ages, we must return to ancient Rome. Rome began to bust apart in the 3rd and 4th centuries AD, and people wanted little to do with hard, Aristotelian philosophy during this decline and fall. Instead, they lusted after transcendent and redemptive religion, and the expansive empire had provided the goods. From Asia Minor, the Romans learned to worship the great Earth Mother. From Egypt, they heard of the cult of Isis. From Persia, the bull-slaying savior god of Mithras was made available. Then, of course, there was the universal god of the Stoics, the Logos Spermaticos. Ultimately, the need for salvation would couple with the notion of a one true God, and Rome would turn to Christianity. Perhaps the most critical point in this philosophical transformation from pagan Rome to papal Rome, short of the conversion of Constantine itself, came with Plotinus, born in Roman-occupied Egypt about 200 years after the supposed life and death of Jesus. Plotinus would unwittingly become the bridge between ancient and medieval philosophy. Plotinus was a Platonist, though his contributions were so unique and so profound that his philosophy is now known as Neoplatonism, to separate it from your garden variety Platonism. Plato had written of a monotheistic God, justified by reason and philosophy, 600 years before Plotinus. Xenophanes had done so nearly 100 years before Plato, and so had the Stoics nearly 100 years after Plato. Though he himself was not a Christian, it was Plotinus's development of this God that would inform Roman Christianity, and therefore global Christianity, most intimately. Indeed, just 110 years after his death, Christianity was the official religion of the Roman Empire. Plotinus agreed with Xenophanes in the Stoics that God was unfathomable, and he agreed with Plato that all things that we perceive in the world are mere shadows of true, divine realities. Combining these ideas, Plotinus concluded that God was the ultimate truth, and thus that all things emanated from him. God, with a capital G, was the source of all reality, the center of a series of concentric circles rippling in a pond. The farther something is away from God, the less real it is, and yet the circles that are farthest away must be the largest. Most people live their lives miserably unaware of divine truth, and muddle about in lives filled with illusions. But as we move inward, closer and closer to the center, we find smaller circles representing purer, more divine beings, dancing around God himself at the origin point of reality. Here's the great esoteric philosopher Manly P. Hall for more on Neoplatonic theology.
In the Neoplatonic system, this eternal, unconditioned existence, by its own inevitables, produces from itself that which is inferior to itself. And this emanation, or perhaps more completely and correctly, this power that oozed from it, that descended out of its own nature simultaneously from all of its parts, the Neoplatonists called nous. And this was the world mind. Neoplatonism arose then as an effort to link the philosophy of Plato with the need for a spiritual, emotional experience of truth. This experience of truth could not be merely the transference of information. No individual could say to another man confidentially, "This is the truth." Even if it was so, and even if the statement was true, there could be no communication of truth apart from a dynamic experience which involved the immediate sense of internal knowing on the part of the person to whom the so-called truth was communicated. Truth could never be anything worldly. It could never be the truth about planets or comets or the tides or the seasons. This truth had to be the all truth, which was man's experience of the true discovery of his relationship to everything that exists, including himself. And in order to have this experience, he must also have the full experience of the wonderful world structure to which he was intimately related. He must not only think of God and about God, he must think with God. So Neoplatonism was this search for truthful thinking, thinking with the mind of God. Thus, as the Hermetic philosophers might have assumed God to be absolute law, and the Gnostic school absolute good or absolute virtue, So in the Neoplatonic school, God was the continuous state of absolute knowing. God knows all things. God is a state of eternal knowing without center or circumference. That which knows all things notes also the sparrow's fall. God is a universal knowing beyond mind, a knowing which is seated in the heart-mind structure of every creature, so that man is capable of a kind of knowing that is without mind, a kind of knowing that is strangely passionless, and yet when experienced, is a total experience from which no part of the being can escape, and which causes afterwards the individual to say, with a strange finality of revelation, I know. Yet this same person could not say what he knows, because his knowledge is not of things, but of the eternal value which lies beneath all things. Thus, knowing in Neoplatonism is practically and functionally this internal power to know value, to apperceive or apprehend essential essence in things, and to experience identity with essence. Neoplatonism, therefore, would follow in the Buddhist concept that while man seems to have a mind and seems to have a knowing power, he is actually knowing with the mind of God, whether he knows it or not. And this mind, which seems to be his, is actually an eternal mind, the eternity of which he has not recognized or accepted. Thus, Neoplatonism carries with it a certain pattern of acceptances. Acceptances of the presence of value where it might not immediately be suspected.
The ideas of Plotinus were forever grafted onto Christian thought by the Neoplatonist turned Christian, Saint Augustine of Hippo. He argued, like his Neoplatonic influencers, that the material world was subordinate to the ideal or spiritual world, and that ultimate knowledge of God could not come by reason or by critical thinking, but by divine revelation and faith alone. If reason could help someone come to feel God, then more power to them. But, like the Stoics had said, reason was only useful if it helped one to live a virtuous, pious life. Augustine draped a Christian veil over a Platonic philosophy, and it was that hybrid that swept Europe, and perhaps it was able to do so thoroughly because it was a hybrid. Even the Neoplatonic idea of divine emanation, the ripples in the pond, led to the Christian concept of a great chain of being, that is, a set of divine hierarchies, hierarchies which are not explicitly laid out in the Bible, and yet have become central to Christian theology for well over 1,000 years. In this episode, we have seen the strange progression of Greco-Roman thinking, all starting with Socrates' simple question, why? From there, all hell broke loose. We got Aristotelian science and formal logic, Stoic virtue, Neoplatonic theology, and, in the end, Christianity, which had once been a religion of refugees, transformed into a worldview properly mystical for an imperial people devoid of hope. Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle taught that the truth is objective and knowable through the careful application of reason. Later philosophers, however, instead argued that the truth goes beyond reason, and that only mystical experience could lead one to it. By the end of the 4th century AD, with some help from the Romans, much of Europe began to seek the truth of faith over the truth of reason, as the continent surrendered itself to a mysterious, all-knowing, and universal, which in Greek is Katholikos, God. Thanks for listening to A Brief History of Critical Thinking, Part 2, The Life Examined. Stay tuned for the next installment of this series, where we look at how critical thinking continued to develop in the millennium that the one universal Catholic Church reigned over Europe.